Mr. Isgit, am I pronouncing that correctly?
That is absolutely correct.
Go ahead.
Please, the Court. It's been my pleasure to accompany this case from its inception in the state of Texas to the federal court in San Antonio, to the federal court in Indiana, and now to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. The point in front of us today is very simple. It's a very narrow point of law. And the simple point is this. When there is evidence of fraud in the inducement of a contract, is the party that was alleging to be fraudulently induced required to prove independent fraud for the integration clause in a contract? Indiana courts fairly well based their decisions on the case of Circle Center Development Company, as did Magistrate Hussman in this case. Magistrate Hussman simply said that if you cannot show that the integration clause was fraudulently induced, then the fraudulent inducement in the remainder of the contract is of no value because the integration clause precludes parole evidence. In so doing, Magistrate Hussman cited Circle Center and relied in that strict one proposition. Circle Center goes further, and Magistrate Hussman missed, I think, or did not apply, that you could overcome the effect or the import of an integration clause if you could show that you had a right to rely upon the fraudulent misrepresentation, and that you did, in fact, rely on the fraudulent misrepresentation.
Is the rest of the contract in the record someplace?
Excuse me, sir?
The rest of the contract. You just cite paragraph 9.
There's two pages, and it's in the record. Yes, sir.
Is it something that you submitted? That I'm kind of looking for. I couldn't find it.
I show it at 133-3. In the record of the court.
Well, I mean, it's not in your brief or anything.
It's in the brief as an attachment, I believe.
It is? I'm sorry, I must have missed it.
The integration clause in the covenant not to execute.
Attachment to your brief in our court?
Yes, sir.
That 133.3 is the district court docket, right?
District court. And it's in the record.
We don't have it, in other words. I mean, maybe we wouldn't get that. It's not here. That's all I'm saying. I'd be curious what the other 8 paragraphs say. That's all.
And my apologies, that is not before the court, but the covenant not to execute in the Atkinson case simply says the parties agree that this agreement represents the party's sole agreement and that Indiana law shall govern the interpretation of the agreement. That's it. Period. Nothing else.
You do agree that that's an integration clause, right?
That's the magistrate called it one. We all agreed that it was one. In Circle Center case, which was the landmark case, the integration clause is much more elaborate. It speaks in terms of the parties conducting independent investigations. It speaks in terms of they're not relying on anyone else except their own attorneys and their own investigation. In the Atkinson case, no such language appears. The fraudulent misrepresentation was really the whole basis for the covenant not to execute. The defendants agreed to a judgment in the Indiana court, and a covenant not to execute was signed on two premises. One, that a coverage action which was pending in the state court of Indiana would be pursued, and that Atkinson could participate in the declaratory judgment action then pending. The other material portion was that an errors and omissions claim that Kinray, the appellees, had in Indiana against the insurance agent would be assigned to Atkinson. There was representations made, there were statements made that the agent had misrepresented the extent of the coverage, misrepresented that the coverage would cover the claims of Atkinson. After the litigation against the agent commenced, depositions were taken, and the agent stated specifically that he never made such a representation. In fact, he met with the appellee, Charles McGee, and said to him, you know this policy has no coverage for the Atkinson claim. Mr. McGee was then deposed, and he admitted that that's what the agent had told him, contrary to the representations he had made prior to the covenant not to execute and at the time the covenant not to execute was indeed signed. When this was discovered, Atkinson filed a motion to set aside the covenant not to compete in order, not to execute, in order to allow it to execute on the agreed judgments. Magistrate Hussman ruled that if there was no independent evidence that the integration clause was procured, was a result of fraud in the inducement, then there could be no setting aside of the covenant not to execute. That brought us here. And so the court is called upon to make one narrow ruling, and that is whether or not Indiana law allows the Atkinsons to overcome the effect of the integration clause.
Mr. Iskett, is there some courts have recognized a difference between straightforward integration clauses and integration clauses with non-reliance provisions? That is, integration clauses, the first being what we have here, which seems to me just a statement that's the entire agreement, the latter being an integration clause that also contains, as it did in Circle Center and some of the other cases, more. In other words, that in addition, we state that we're not relying upon prior representations, we've done our own investigation. Should the analysis with regard to those two situations be different? And if so, I guess how and why?
Okay. Circle Center, which all Indiana courts seem to be grasping and latching onto, including the new case of Windwire, which we cited in the supplemental brief, says, and it should be decided on a case-by-case basis. If you look at the integration clause in the Windwire, it was a disclaimer more than it was an integration, where they disclaimed warranties, they disclaimed oral warranties, they disclaimed express warranties, written warranties, and this was a suit for breach of warranty. The Indiana court in the Windwire case says there was the parties were fraudulently induced into signing a release, even though it had the disclaimer.
Of course, there you've got a couple of consumers against this corporate entity. Here we've got two well-represented parties negotiating this covenant not to execute.
Exactly. But Circle Center still says, to apply it to the specific facts, were the Atkinsons entitled to rely on the representations? And did they, in fact, rely on the misrepresentations to the effect that there was an errors and omissions coverage when Kinray knew there was none? We simply argued to Magistrate Hussman during the briefing in Indiana that we should be allowed to produce evidence of all of the fraudulent misrepresentations and the reliance, and to prove that we were entitled to rely on those misrepresentations in signing the covenant not to execute.
You are in your rebuttal time.
Excuse me.
It's up to you.
I'm going to save it for rebuttal time. Thank you.
Is it Everwine or Everwine?
Yes, Your Honor. Eric Everwine.
Mr. Everwine.
May it please the Court, Eric Everwine for the defendant appellees. Really, Indiana law, I think, as we've heard, is pretty clear on this particular matter. As Magistrate Hussman noted in his order in this case, a party who signs a contract that has an integration clause in it can only be relieved of that contract by showing that there was some sort of fraud in the inducement of the integration clause itself.
Is that what the TruCal case?
That's articulated, I think, it originates in the Prawl case and is picked up in TruCal and also Circle Center, and then Windwire articulates that as well.
It seems to me in the TruCal case that the Indiana Court of Appeals said that you could go beyond inducements related to the integration clause to show that the agreement itself was fraudulently induced.
Yeah, if you can show that there was an intent that the representations caused reliance on that integration clause. But, yeah, that exception was...
Sounds to me like that's what Atkinson wants to do here.
Well, that's exactly what Magistrate Hussman recognized, and he provided, and Magistrate Hussman provided Atkinson the opportunity to present evidence at an evidentiary hearing specifically addressing this issue of whether or not that their reliance on these alleged representations concerning an errors and omissions claim against the insurance agent constituted fraud and inducement related to that integration clause itself. Magistrate Hussman set that evidentiary hearing. There were motions to extend the briefing time, to continue the hearing, and then ultimately Atkinson filed a motion to remand without having ever presented any evidence to the district court in support of their contention. So it's not that the district court didn't recognize that, yeah, there are exceptions where you should be allowed to present evidence specifically showing that there's fraud in the inducement as to this. But, again, it goes back to where you have an integration clause, and this is exactly what Magistrate Hussman found and is the predicate to this, that the blissfully simple integration clause that says the parties agreed this agreement represents the party's sole agreement. If that is an integration clause, then I think you have to give effect to that. It says that that is probative of the intent of the parties to disclaim reliance on any prior or contemporaneous oral statements or written statements.
But isn't that different than an affirmative non-reliance provision? In other words, a statement that affirmatively states this is an entire agreement, and we also state that we are not going to rely upon any statements made by any of the other parties up to this point other than that set forth in this agreement.
Judge Lee, I think that goes to your earlier comment about does Indiana make that kind of distinction? Do you have to have those types of specific provisions in an integration clause? My sense is no. I've not seen anything that requires any type of specific magic language that says specifically disclaims prior reliances. I think that if the question is what does this mean, we don't need to look much further than the deposition of Eric Atkinson in this case, who represents both the appellant corporations. When I asked him, what do you think this means, the unequivocal response was, is it means that the party's deal, the party's agreement, is contained within the four corners of these two pages, with the exception that the agreed judgments are also incorporated by reference. I think so there was no misunderstanding here of exactly what this meant. And I think it is an express disclaimer by operation of law of any other prior or contemporaneous oral or written statements.
With regard to the Center City decision, and in that case, the Court of Appeals relied upon Prawl.
Right.
And as I read Prawl, doesn't Prawl allow the parties to present fraudulent inducement evidence with regard to the entire contract? I mean, they were dealing with the release.
Right.
And so in the court in Prawl said that basically so long as representation was made that must have induced or produced execution of the release, i.e. the contract at issue there, mm-hmm. or contributed to its cause, that would satisfy the requirements to show fraudulent inducement as to the entire agreement. So doesn't Prawl support the appellant's position that you don't have to limit the fraudulent inducement only to the integration clause? In other words, isn't the court in Center City and perhaps the magistrate judge reading Prawl too narrowly?
I think that potentially that is a too narrow reading. I think that
in looking at the magistrate judge's order setting the hearing, he says that before he can consider the question of whether the covenant not to execute can be set aside, he must conduct a hearing to determine whether Atkinson can show fraud in the inducement of the integration clause itself and not the contract generally.
Correct.
So that seems to be the reading that Judge Lee suggests, that is much narrower than Prawl would allow.
Well, I think that the basis for that kind of narrow reading and saying it has to be limited to the integration, whether it's fraud in the integration clause itself, particularly here, is because that's the whole point of an integration clause. That's why it's there, is it specifically disclaims that. So how can you have it both ways? How can you have an affirmative...
The clause in this case says nothing about any other representations that may have been made that caused Atkinson to enter this agreement. It just says this is the sole agreement. It says nothing about what was represented to it.
Correct. I would concede that it is not fraught with legalese. And it is, aside from the alliteration of agreement, it is pretty clear, I think, and blissfully simple in terms of what it's saying. This is the agreement, this and no more. Now, is the requirement in the law that we include in every integration clause every synonym for a potential agreement? Or for any representation, utterances, statements, nudges, winks. How detailed does it have to be if the sole purpose of an integration clause is to say this is the agreement, we all agree, this is the deal? Then what purpose is really served by adding on superfluous language that goes beyond that? It certainly satisfies my instincts as an attorney, I guess, to see it as detailed as possible. I know that some of my law professors would be pleased to see that this is a case where we've cut through the legalese and we've made this a simple, straightforward agreement. And remember, Your Honors, the attorneys drafted this. This is not a boilerplate agreement. This is not a form, as the case like in the America's Directories cases or some of these others where you have pre-printed boilerplate. This is something that's negotiated by sophisticated parties, represented by counsel, who have the opportunity to talk and discuss this. There's really no question of an understanding of what this means, at least as far as the principle for the appellants is concerned. And so I guess the question is, if it doesn't mean that it's a disclaimer of reliance on prior representations and contemporary statements, what on earth could it possibly mean? And it seems to me that it is simply functional in that respect. And as far as the statements, the alleged statements themselves, Mr. Isgut mentioned the questions concerning the errors and omissions claim. I think it's important to note that none of that was ever resolved. There's not been any kind of judicial finding in terms of whether or not there was truly an errors and omissions claim. That case was decided on summary judgment because the statute of limitations was blown. So the question of whether or not there was ever really an errors and omissions claim never got to a jury. The world will never know what ultimately occurred there. So, at the time that this covenant was executed, this contract was executed, all of these things were potentialities in the future, any errors and omissions claim at some point in the future.
I'm a little confused by your supplemental statement filed in our court. What are you contending that Atkinson is arguing that's new or different in its reply brief?
Well, essentially, Your Honor, is that they raised additional facts that weren't in their preliminary brief, and primarily relying on the deposition testimony of the insurance agent who was then the target of the litigation. And I think what it does is it puts some of this the facts out of context in terms of what the timeline was and what the context of those statements were made. I think back in December of 2004 when...
They argued facts they hadn't argued before.
Well, they had been raised at some point in the initial briefs in the district court, but they were not asserted in the context of Magistrate Hussman's request for an evidentiary hearing on the specific narrow issue before the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
2 minutes, if you need it.
See if I can bring it under two, Judge.
If we're to follow Magistrate Hussman's ruling and say that that's the law in Indiana, what we are saying is that regardless of the existence of fraud in the inducement of the contract, if you cannot prove fraud in the wording of in obtaining the wording of the integration clause, the other fraud doesn't make any difference. I was astounded that counsel was saying there's no evidence of fraud when the record is full of evidence where the very defendant who obtained the covenant not to execute admitted that what he said was untrue. That's as close to fraud as I ever see in where I live. And I think it's close to fraud in Indiana and as well as anywhere else. Circle Center Development Company and Prawl both say whether one has the right to rely depends largely on the facts of the case. This was a covenant not to execute that was signed on the day, on the first day of testimony in a jury trial in New Albany, Indiana. The trial was stopped, the agreed judgment was entered, and the covenant not to execute was signed as well. Under the circumstances of that case and under the prior representations made by the defendants, there's no question that Atkinson was entitled to rely and that Atkinson is entitled to establish the fraud in its motion to set aside the covenant not to execute. That's all I have. All right,
thank you, and thank you to both counsel. We'll take it under advisement.